Taking Stock with Susan Hayes Cullerton.
With Nifty Business, the fleet management specialists. Keeping your business fleet moving with service you can count on.
This is News Talk.
Well, hello and welcome to Taking Stock. I'm Susan Hayes Cullerton and this is the show that looks at business and economics from a wider perspective. Now, coming up on today's show, author, columnist and OBE recipient Gillian Tett on the strange state of world economics. Is Europe remaking itself in the time of Trump and are new alliances being formed? Plus, the world's two most famous tech bros go head to head in court over AI and we will discuss it. You can email the show, takingstock@newstalk.com. Or you can message me on socials at Susan Hayes Cullerton. Now, I want to start off this week by sharing an observation I'm seeing, which I think might be the start of a very significant business model change. So I'm going to give the context, first of all, with an example. Let's say I bought Microsoft 95 back in the day, right? So I bought a license to it and I could have used that as much as I wanted. And then when an upgrade came along years later, like Microsoft 97, I'd have bought a new license. Now, step forward to a business model change and we had the leap into SaaS. So that was software as a service. Then you didn't buy licenses anymore. You bought seats and the upgrades were far more frequent. The cost as well was lower. So then you were paying on a monthly or an annual basis. But I've noticed that we're seeing a steady move towards costs per usage now. And I think that's triggered by the energy used by AI and the amount of prompting needed in, also a newer term, vibe coding. So I have been seeing this myself, this cost per usage model. It's been filtering into the technology we've been using here. But the reason that I'm telling you about this now is it was a very significant theme in Microsoft's earnings this week. And I'm quoting CFO Amy Hood, who says, "Just this week, we announced a business model transition in GitHub Copilot," many of you will be familiar with that, "that will align pricing with usage and value that takes effect on June 1st of this year." And Satya Nadella then went on to talk about the category economics of it. So I think this really could change a lot in how businesses factor in the price of AI for staff and also how we're seeing the growing use of AI agents. So this is something to watch out for. So watch this space. Well, they were two kindred spirits bound by shared political beliefs. Their relationship was going to reshape conservative politics on both sides of the Atlantic. Could Donald Trump and Giorgia Meloni be this century's Reagan and Thatcher? Well, that's no longer the case, as the relationship is fractured by a number of issues, which I'm going to delve right into now with Julia Crapton-Harharger, Professor of Critical, Cultural and International Studies at Colorado State University, to the show. First off, Julia, Giorgia Meloni, if she remains in office, she is set to break the record of being the longest serving government by September the 4th, 2026. And at a European level, she was described as a reference point for national conservative forces seeking to combine Eurosceptic rhetoric, anti-immigration policies and culture war themes with disciplined economic and foreign policy management. How is that working out now?
It's a good question. So time will tell, of course, as cliche as it sounds. But what should be said about Giorgia Meloni, she is an incredibly careful and pragmatic leader. We call her a bridge because even what she has successfully managed until recently was to bridge a lot of parties, a lot of players. She was the bridge between Europe and the United States. Originally, people were very concerned to imagine a nationalist, a populist, and head of the country with the roots of her original party having fascist roots. And at the end, we'll see that she is still managing quite well. And she is she proved herself to be a little bit more centrist than anything else, incredibly pragmatic and very, very, I want to say, chameleon-like. We also use, in critical cultural studies, we use this phrase of cultural and political chameleon. Because she's incredibly capable on that, in that regard. And she is also very good at building connections within Europe. So we will see how that will work out.
Okay. She's great indeed at all of the things that you've mentioned. And that assumes that the person on the other side of the relationship warms to her or where she can find that common ground. And it looked like up until recently that she was able to manage that well with Trump as well. But due to Greenland, tariffs, NATO spending, Ukraine, and particularly the tipping point of Iran, how do you see that playing out now with the White House?
I do not think that will continue, and there are, as you mentioned, all those reasons because President Trump proved to be predictably unpredictable, so it became a challenge to rely on the United States with this famous Western alliance to begin with. Giorgia Meloni tried to do this as long as she could, but eventually she needed to choose between Europe and the United States. And I do not see how that bridge would continue to be reliable. It also doesn't help that President Trump openly critiqued her. So we went from her being beautiful and the most promising leader of Europe now to lacking courage, being completely the opposite of what he thought she would be. So there were attacks. She wasn't engaged in any of his plans. And I must say that President Trump also required absolutely unconditional loyalty in all his decisions, even the decisions that were fundamentally in conflict with the values of European leaders. So you combine it with the war in Iran, you combine it with the attacks on the Pope, and I just don't see how that should go on. So Giorgia Meloni did what she had to do, which is disengage from that relationship and concentrate primarily on the pro-European course.
Is it serving her to do that?
Absolutely, because right now there is a lot of unpopularity of the US-American leader all over Europe, and specifically in Italy. The polls are showing that 82% of Europeans and Italians are in strong disagreement of Trumpian policies and his politics and his tariffs and everything. So absolutely, it's not just serving her, it's an absolute necessity nationally, especially with her a little bit crumbling popularity in Italy right now after she lost that constitutional referendum, the strong opposition. So Italy is not in the easiest place to begin with right now, and that was kind of almost a necessity. So yes.
There is a phrase, never waste a good crisis. And I do wonder, as I'm listening to you,
Yes.
whether the fact that Meloni, as well as there's other parts of Europe that I want to hop around in our conversation today, but when we take Merz, when we take Macron, etc., is Trump basically offering the opportunity now for, as I'm about to quote you in your piece this week in The Conversation, where the EU can now finally see itself as a political actor in its own right, in a unified way?
Oh, absolutely, absolutely. A lovely German phrase comes to mind, Glück im Unglück, which is luck in the unlucky situation, because right now, Europe has no choice but to become better, to become faster, to become more united, and to rethink its policies, to rethink its approach. So, absolutely. And we see this also recently. So we used to talk about a very strong coalition between Germany and France. Now we talk a lot about Italy and Germany, and even this phrase Merzoni, so that leadership. We see that there is a lot more activity and a lot more happening in Europe with regard to its future, to its rearmament, to its policies towards many things such as war, energy supplies, migration. So I believe that it might be exactly that, cold shower, cold shock of reality, and a little bit this wake-up call, if you wish, to make the European Union and Europe in general stronger and an actor in its own right.
Or maybe just it has a purpose to have a combined conversation with urgency. You mentioned a German phrase there. We have a one in Ireland as well, or in Irish, which is it's an ill wind that blows no good. But I also wonder, though, if we do shift to Germany for a moment, where is the luck in bad luck there? Because Merz seems to be certainly being assertive with his rhetoric, that is for sure. But when you look at the economic reports coming out of Germany, despite all of the excitement that there was at the beginning of the year and a little bit before it as well, about how the debt brake was off and how there was going to be so much spending in military and there was going to be so much of a boost to the German economy, the Iran war has really hurt, it seems, both politically and economically, Germany? And therefore, how do you sell that message then to a domestic audience?
Oh, well, that's currently a very difficult question, because Merz currently is one of the most unpopular leaders in Germany, and his popularity is crumbling faster than that of Meloni. But he's trying to play the long game. That's my understanding, because this rearmament of Europe was and is driven by Merz. He's a very pragmatic leader as well. One of his famous works is Give Capitalism a Chance. So he is trying to approach it incredibly pragmatically. And maybe right now, the idea is, okay, we'll lose a couple of battles, but we'll win a longer war over a united, stronger Europe, also with a lot of emphasis on self-sufficiency and security of Europe long run.
I find that interesting about the strategic autonomy, that whole sense of self-sufficiency, because when I look at the procurement that Germany is engaging in, though, an awful lot of what Germany is spending in terms of defence is finding its way to the US. So is he speaking out of both sides of his mouth?
Well, once again, complicated, because on the one hand, there are spendings in terms of, equipment and armament. And even right now, as we speak, there is this strong incentive between the two, Germany and Italy, to move forward, right, with armament and production of more and more equipment. But at the same time, Germany is trying to rethink its own national policy on young people serving in the army, which was not the case for decades, because after the famous Nie wieder, never again. So the idea was, we will be peaceful, we don't need all this. Now we need to think about the ancient Roman maxim of, if you want to prepare, if you want to have peace, prepare for war. So I don't know that he has any choice. And it's difficult to speak about Merz and Germany in particular, because even though Germany is the strongest economy in Europe, it still needs to be a joint effort. And traditionally, it used to be Germany and France together. But with the upcoming election in France, we also don't know what will happen there. So to your question, we will see how things will unfold. I think the incentive of Germany is to make its national standing stronger, its military standing stronger, its independency of different resources and alliance on big players like the United States to disengage from that and make itself stronger. If it will happen, how successful it will be, we don't know just yet.
Julia, since we're continuing to ask with the hard questions, I may as well keep going. And I want to ask you about something you said about Merz a while ago, which is that he is playing the long game. And I want to also bring Macron into this conversation as well at this point, because when I look at French politics over the past year, he's had, I think it's at this stage, 5 different prime ministers under 2 years in France. Dramatic issues in trying to push budgets through. Merz has got elections in the eastern states in September, and AFD, Alternative for Germany, is polling strongly at the moment.
Yep.
Can I ask if you think that democracy in both countries is going to reward longer term thinking? History would, economics would, but can democracy reward that, do you think?
I think that it's one of the most wicked problems, how to preserve democracy and how to preserve also the living standards of the Europeans as they are used to having them, because there are a lot of factors that go into this. Macron has always been a very passionate Europeanist and one of the most passionate advocates of democracy, but he will be gone relatively soon, so we don't know what will happen in France. And since you're mentioning AFD, we also can talk about, we can talk hours about the potentiality of Brexit and also the extremely popular French right and also the unpopularity of Macron in his own country. So right now, European democracy is a little bit in crisis. I have to say. But I also have to say that democracy is the foundational principle of Europe as we know it. It was, you know, it was born in Europe. And so what I think right now is democracy will win, in my hopeful and humble opinion, but it might just take different forms and certain compromises on the economic level, on the level of international politics. Certain compromises and adjustments will need to be made, and which ones we will see.
I think it's interesting what you say about compromise, because you speak in your piece about a geopolitical quartet, and that includes Germany, France, Italy and the UK. And I'm always at pains to highlight the difference between when I'm speaking about Europe, the European Union, the Eurozone, because of course they all matter in a very different way. But in the context of your piece this week about Europe coming together, you very much include the UK in there. What role do you see the relationship with the UK being? And I'm not just talking about Brexit or a reverse of Brexit or anything else. I'm genuinely talking about I'm going to go back to your phrase, the geopolitical quartet between the four countries. Do you see a rising role for all four of them playing a different but very important role of unity there?
Absolutely. That's why I allowed myself the cheesy little phrase of Meloni and her three musketeers. And just for the record, as a passionate Europeanist, you know, Brexit, I think, was a very sad page in European history. Nonetheless, regardless of Brexit you mentioned, I believe that right now, once again, Europeans, regardless of the United, the European Union or not, we kind of need to have a united, I don't want to say totality because it kind of erases a lot of uniqueness, but we need to be a united union. We need to be stronger together. And I absolutely believe that Britain will play a fundamental role in it. Also because it's among those four strongest economies. It's like those four, this quartet, are also the strongest economies of Europe. And it's like we can never ignore economy when we talk about politics and we talk about power. So my opinion is absolutely yes.
Well, since the show here is in Ireland, Julia, we very much wanted the same thing to happen. And you can be sure we'll be staying put anyway. That seems to be where the national narrative is and consistently has been. So thank you very much indeed for joining me to take a trip in many dimensions around Europe today. And this has been Julia Crapton-Herhager, Professor of Critical, Cultural and International Studies from Colorado State University.
Thank you very much for having me.
This is Susan A's Culleton here on Taking Stock on News Talk. And after the break, it's Musk v. Altman. Welcome back to Taking Stock. I'm Susan A's Culleton. Now, for my trivia question to you all. I was at a medtech conference last week at a stadium in Ireland. Bundy Aki walked past me as I was driving out of the car park. Where do you think I was? I'll give you the answer at the end of the show. Now, we all love a big celebrity trial. The tech bros of Elon Musk and Sam Altman are engaged in one over in Oakland, and my next guest has been following it. It's great to welcome Chris Stokel-Walker of the London Independent back to Taking Stock. First up, Chris, let's go back to when Musk left OpenAI's board in 2018. Was it a resignation? Was it an ejection? What do you think history remembers it to be?
It was a bus stop, I think, is the one word that we can use to describe it, Susan. Of course, part of the key points of this case hinges on how exactly these two titanic egos ended up splitting up. And, you know, there was a difference of opinion, I suppose, about the future direction of OpenAI, the company that Elon Musk and Sam Altman came together to found back in 2015. A vision that was different for the future in terms of that, because, of course, OpenAI, the clue was in the name, was founded as an open company meant to develop AI for the benefit of all of humanity. Elon Musk believed that meant that it didn't need to make a profit or try to make a profit. And obviously Sam Altman, and based on some of the stuff that we are hearing, others within the company felt like there might have been a different approach that could be taken where they could capitalize on that. But yeah, in terms of all of this, I think the one thing that we know is that it was incredibly messy. And that is why we've ended up in court in the last week or so talking about this and having it literally relitigated.
Okay, let's look at the messy divorce, we'll say, because if it was that messy, Musk still said he didn't read the fine print out of a four-page document that explicitly mentioned raising the $10 billion. So do you think Musk knew what he was signing when he left, or is this selective non-recollection?
Well, Elon Musk, of course, runs a platform, now X, formerly Twitter. That is a short-form content platform. It is designed to have, you know, 280 characters or less for each individual post, unless you fork out. And you know, the judge didn't seem to be enormously convinced of the case when it was being discussed in the trial about the idea that actually Elon Musk couldn't even reach a four-page memo. But, you know, there are reasons why we have executive summaries on documents, and they are named executive summaries because executives of companies are incredibly busy people. And at the time, of course, Elon Musk works far more than most other people do. He has many different interests and many different businesses, juggling an awful lot of stuff. But it does seem to maybe stretch the credibility a little bit to say that actually, if you're doing something as consequential as this, and particularly something that you've already had your backup about, that you wouldn't pore over that document in detail.
Okay, and let's give him the benefit of the doubt, okay?
Yeah.
And let's now look at this in the context of just corporate America in general. Is it fair that one could leave a board, sign a document to say that you're leaving and basically whatever the other party does is up to them, and then 8 years later, sue them or take them to court for extraordinary amounts of money in terms of damages because they changed what they did after you left? Like, is that what this case comes down to?
Yeah, well, this case comes down to, and I've seen contemporaneous reporting from various websites. There's a tech website called The Verge, which in advance of the trial called this a very expensive way for Elon Musk to try and get therapy. You know, he is the world's richest man. He has this bee in his bonnet about OpenAI and the way in which he felt it was snatched away from him. In terms of fairness, I think that he absolutely thinks that it is unfair. In terms of whether it's actually a valid legal case, well, you know, even the experts seem to think that there's not an awful lot there to stand on. But I do think that you know, Musk also has a point about fairness the other way. And very rarely will you hear me say that I agree with Elon Musk, but having spoken to legal experts on my own reporting, there is a broader consequence to this than just two billionaires fighting it out in a court for who gets to seem like they are the better person. There is a real risk here that, as well as that idea that Elon Musk was done over effectively when he left and then tried to kind of bring back this case and you know, basically pulled a fast one, it seems, on Elon, on Sam Altman, Greg Brockman and OpenAI. There is the opposing argument that Elon Musk makes, which is it's not right that you can set up a company or an organization at the time, effectively saying we are going to be a charitable endeavor and solicit donations. Then once you've got all that money in, you start to change the purpose of that organization and you maybe use that to pursue a profit while maybe not paying out your original funders. And one of the things that this legal expert that I spoke to said is they worry about the consequences of this on any charity that tries to set up after the fact, because it's a massive disincentive to fund these sorts of things if you believe that actually turns out someone can come around 5, 10, 20 years later, change the whole basis of the company, and then you don't get a penny from it.
And this brings us to Greg Brockman, of course, who now has a $30 billion stake in a charity. And this is the sharpest question, ultimately, of the whole trial. I mean, he does argue that OpenAI is the most well-capitalized non-profit in human history. Do you think, though, and I'm asking you this for your own opinion, do you think, Chris, when they began, did OpenAI genuinely mean to set up something that would help the world? Or, and I'm going back to the diary extracts that, unfortunately, Greg Brockman has had to sit through and listen to his innermost thoughts being shared with the world now. Or did they think, okay, we're going to start in this way. ChatGPT began, oh my God, there's now massive money in this. Microsoft is interested. We now need to take a very different path. Did capitalism overtake the humanitarian effort they were starting off with?
Well, capitalism always ruins everything, Susan, is the first thing that's important to say. The second thing, I think you mentioned Microsoft here, and one of the sort of really interesting wrinkles of this trial is that we are learning just how good Satya Nadella is as an executive of a real big business. You're learning the difference in this trial between the men and the boys. Satya Nadella, none of his embarrassing texts have surfaced because he doesn't send them. He chooses instead to transact his business through phone calls, which then cannot be discovered through legal processes and presented to the world through a trial. But in terms of that founding principle of OpenAI, I think it depends on who you ask out of those founding individuals. Because for Elon Musk, I believe that he probably really thought he was doing something for the benefit of humanity. Now, that's in part because Elon Musk has a bit of a God complex. And you know, one of the things that's really interesting about this trial is the disconnect between the way that Elon Musk sees himself and his impact on the world and the way that pretty much everybody else, apart from perhaps some of his most ardent hangers-on on X, see him. Then you have Sam Altman. Now, Sam Altman, you know, always been questions around him. He's a little bit of an interesting character, a mover, a shaker, made an awful lot of money in the sort of venture capital world. We already had lots of reporting about the fact that he wasn't seen as enormously trustworthy anyway. I think that's been reinforced. And so you have to maybe question his motives behind this, because he wasn't an AI developer, bear in mind. He's a shrewd businessman and always has been. Then you have Greg Brockman, obviously very embarrassing in his diary talking about this. I think he's been lured by the money, but he was one of many researchers in the AI space that were lured to OpenAI in 2015 with the promise of big money contracts. And truthfully, I think that it was the large amounts of money, but also the promise of doing something really good for the benefit of humanity that got a lot of people there. So you know, perhaps the cast of characters that we aren't hearing from in this trial are the ones that had the more virtuous view of what OpenAI would be.
You've mentioned there what the impact of this might mean for charities. But what about the impact of what this might mean for AI development globally?
Well, if OpenAI wins, as they probably will do, then OpenAI continues to go on trucking ahead. Sam Altman vanquishes one of his most hated opponents, someone who's been a thorn in his side for a long, long time. The enmity that you feel between those two is really significant. And I think it boosts Sam Altman's ego, which truthfully doesn't already need much more boosting, because he's managed to survive a boardroom coup, remember, back in November 2023, which everybody thought was going to be him done for. So an already pretty significant ego is going to get very much bigger here. For Elon Musk, if he ends up winning, which I think is enormously unlikely, he can effectively say that he was right all along. He won't win, I think, is pretty much the decision and the ordinary outcome that we're expecting. But if he did win, then it would be significant and would have a massive impact on OpenAI. Because remember, they are trying to launch their IPO later this year. And I think in part that is why Musk has chosen now to bring this to court, is because he wants to have that question mark hanging over OpenAI while they try and invite investment from the public before their flotation on the stock market. So, you know, truthfully, for OpenAI, it's kind of a little bit of a lose-lose. So Sam Altman might win, but actually, you know, OpenAI will still have that challenge. They've been delayed in their IPO because of this. And for the rest of us, well, I don't really know. That's the big challenge. Elon Musk already this week announcing a deal with competitor Anthropic, which suggests that he is not very positive on the outcome of his own AI company. And also, I think, is choosing the moment to try and stick it once again to OpenAI's biggest competitor.
And this is why I'm asking you about the impact and development of AI, because when you say about for the rest of us, we don't know. The reason I'm bringing this up is the council had to intervene in a flat out row that started on the courtroom floor about both parties having their views on how AI could challenge the future of humanity. It's pretty existential and probably unconventional at a courtroom reading, but in both cases, they seem to feel that AI could bring down the world. And that's why I'm asking you this, Chris.
Yeah, I think that they have different views of how the world might be brought down. And both of them, I think, are equally partly delusional. Elon Musk's view of bringing down the world is literally that the world could be brought down. That if we go too far with the development of AI, we end up with a superintelligence, a Terminator-style machine that could end up killing us all. I think that's in part just his love of sci-fi and the fact that he is also developing humanoid robots through Tesla. So, he's putting two and two together and getting five there. For Sam Altman, I think there's this idea that economically and in terms of our working world, everything will change because AI is a hugely powerful tool, and OpenAI is putting this into businesses, into the workplace, into our workforces in lots of different ways. And I think that he sees this, he's a real true believer in the transformational element of this and believes that actually we could see massive economic upheaval because of the disappearance of entry-level jobs.
It's intriguing to watch, and it will be very interesting to see where this goes, not just to see who actually wins the case, but how the narrative changes, whether it might be for philanthropy and charity, development of AI, as you say, the combinations as well of the companies thereafter, and the existential conversation that you've just finished up on. Really appreciate your time, and thanks so much for joining us today. Chris Stokel-Walker of the London Independent.
Thank you.
This is Susan A's Cullerton here on Taking Stock on News Talk. Up next, I'm joined in studio by author and columnist Gillian Tett, who thinks the markets don't really care about war. Now, you're welcome back to Taking Stock here on News Talk. I'm Susan A's Cullerton. And I wanted to read out a message to you that we received this week. Dear Susan, I'm a senior citizen, and up until your presence on News Talk's Taking Stock, I have not found it possible to understand the complexity of economics. I get great pleasure in listening to your down-to-earth analysis and incisive questioning. Now, first, I want to thank Dennis Murray sincerely for sending such a lovely message. But I also want to make the point that economics really is for everybody. I didn't study it in secondary school myself, as it wasn't an option, and I only started it in college. It's a topic that endlessly fascinates me, and I really hope that week by week we can bring it to life for every single one of you all the more. Thanks again, Dennis. Now, global markets are climbing to record highs even as the world faces deep instability from war in the Middle East and energy shocks to weakening consumer confidence and rising geopolitical tension. But I'm keen to explore the question of how we keep looking for connections between financial markets and everyday economic reality, and actually whether we're looking in the right places. Joining me now to discuss this is Gillian Tett, columnist and member of the editorial board at the Financial Times. First off, Gillian, you've taught me a new word in your most recent piece. You say that we have a growing tendency to anthropomorphize the stock market. Five syllables, and I tried to get it in one there. But will you tell us, what does that mean, first of all, and how does that come to life?
Well, using a word like that probably makes me sound like a sort of, posh professor or something like that. And I am actually also linked to Cambridge University. So
you actually are a posh professor.
I'm not a professor, but I run a college there called King's College. And anthropomorphize basically means that you are treating the stock market as if it wasn't just a bunch of numbers or an abstract thing out there, but as a living being that has feelings and moods and sentiments and thoughts of its own. And there's a growing tendency to do that, to treat it as if it was a real life thing or creature that, as we like to say, feels upset at latest data releases, or it decides to, test a new level in the stock market or something like that. So that's really what's going on at the moment, as people increasingly look at the stock market, not just as a mirror to ourselves and a barometer about how we feel about the future, but also almost like a quasi-god or sometimes demon that's keeping tabs on us all.
Oh, wow. That is deep and meaningful there. So I would like to challenge the assumption, though, that you bring up in the piece, which is that it's a mirror. And the reason I'm challenging this is in the context of it being a mirror to the world economy, because US stocks now account for about 63% of global stock market capitalization. That's up from about 30 to 35% in 2010. And yet the US contributes around about 26% of global GDP. So, and that's only the US. We'll get to the other parts of the world. But therefore, are we really looking at the right place then and looking at the stock market to reflect what's going on in the real economy?
I think it's an absolutely brilliant question, because the reality is that, to use another big word, there's been an enormous amount of financialization in America. And that means treating everything in life as if it was an asset which could be bought or sold and have a price put on it. And the capital markets, the stock market and the bond market, have exploded in size, not just relative to the past in America, but relative to other countries. And the American stock market has gone up dramatically. And as a result, when people talk about the global stock market, what they're increasingly talking about is the American stock market.
And even within that, because the Mag 7 are a third of that, are they increasingly talking about really the earnings of the big hyperscalers?
Absolutely. And this really is a lot of both American triumphalism and tech triumphalism. And that matters enormously right now when you look at the markets, because although in some ways the Iran war is a major America problem, just like the subprime mortgage crisis back in 2007 was a made in American problem, the bitter, ghastly irony of what's going on is that just as America recovered from the subprime problems faster than other people, in this current case, America's probably better insulated against the economic fallout of the Iran war than most other countries.
Is that down to the fact that it's now a net exporter of energy, or is there something else to it?
A lot of it is down to the fact that it actually has enormous fossil fuel industry itself, unlike many other countries, like Ireland, for example. The other issue, though, is that the tech sector is booming and driving a lot of growth. And if you dive into the numbers right now in the American economy, you can see the capital expenditure around data centers is responsible for a lot of the actual economic growth right now overall. And on top of that, America went into the whole Iran war with a much stronger economy that was growing faster than many other rivals. And so as a result, it has more reserves or cushion, if you like, to protect itself.
If we just leave America for the moment and we look at the emerging markets, they comprise just about 12% of the MSCI ACWI, which itself is the global index. And yet they only, yet they represent about 40 to 50% now of global GDP, depending on whether you look at nominal or PPP terms, and about 60% of global real worth over the past two decades. And of course, they are far more exposed to what's going on in the energy markets and indeed the fallout of other things as well, whether it might be the lack of fertilizer getting through the strait, the impact of increased inflation, etc. So again, I ask the question, Gillian, are we totally underestimating what's going on in another big part of the world where a lot of the growth is happening by simply, again, looking at global stock markets?
I think we absolutely are underestimating that. And I think the issue is, as Kristalina Georgieva, the head of the International Monetary Fund, pointed out recently, and I saw her just the other day in the IMF released a report on this, that we're seeing an unbelievably uneven situation around the world right now, which frankly is very cruel.
Do you mean the K-shaped economy or something else?
Well, it's a version of the K-shaped economy, but in terms of countries, in that on the one hand, America's still, it appears to be growing pretty fast, but there's a lot of other emerging market economies that are really suffering. And of course, Europe is in the crosshairs, because not only is it facing a wave of dumping from China and competition from China on the export side, it's also dealing with a real squeeze, a nasty squeeze in terms of the energy prices. And it had a much slower pace of growth, if not economic stagnation to start with. So in some ways, it's profoundly unfair what's going on.
But when you say cruel as distinct to unfair, there's a different connotation in both of them. Cruel suggests that some party is inflicting this.
Well, I didn't mean cruel in the sense of, you know, there being a deliberate war in the emerging markets economies per se at all. It's more a case that because the Strait of Hormuz has become a key lever in this war in terms of how Iran is trying to stand up to America and exercise some leverage in their talks by effectively closing it, that doesn't just hit, obviously, the energy exports, but the fertilizer and other petrochemical exports as well. And who's going to be hit by a loss of fertilizer? Well, yes, it will be to some degree places like America, but places like Pakistan or Bangladesh or many parts of Southeast Asia that are going to be squeezed. And the cruelty is that these, of course, are the countries least well-equipped to actually weather it. And what you see right now is a very interesting split between countries like China, which have been stockpiling huge amounts of spare resources and reserves of everything from fossil fuels through to fertilizer and rare earth minerals and beyond, and a place like Pakistan that has not been able to do that at all in the past few years. One lesson is going to be, of course, that everyone now is going to go into hoarding mode and be trying to stockpile everything in a way that we saw last during COVID.
Well, I would argue that did we not see that as well with the tariff situation, trying to, particularly from the perspective of countries and businesses, trying to hoard inventory to get ahead of that?
We definitely saw it with tariffs. That was more in the case of individual companies, though, trying to engage in hoarding. What you're likely to see going forward is a debate in many countries, including Europe as well, about what kind of national strategic reserves they need to protect themselves. And it's the same national version of what households were doing during COVID with toilet rolls. You know, you start to panic, you go and buy up everything you can find. Suddenly the shelves are empty, the prices go up, and that engenders more panic. So hoarding is never a particularly good thing for economic growth, but it seems pretty much inevitable now.
And of course, in a whole other connotation, we could talk about labour hoarding and AI and all that, which we could do on another occasion. I would like to ask you about the tectonic plates of the world changing, though, because there seems to be a narrative that AI is really growing in Silicon Valley. And you highlight that particularly in your tour to New York, Washington, London, San Francisco and Dublin now, as you're here with us in studio. But also, if we look at China, China has been not just backing AI and coming up with its own developments there, but green energy, huge investments in R&D. Momentum has been growing there, partly quietly, and it seems that they're quite happy for the US and Europe to be looking to the West while they're quietly building in the East. How do you see the geopolitical and, yeah, the tectonic plates of the world changing?
Well, in terms of China, it's emerging as one of the winners of the current fight in the Middle East because it's been sitting there very quietly, looking at America essentially suffer what's in many ways a strategic defeat in the Middle East, expend a lot of its military without much to actually show for it at the moment, and suffer real damage. And of course, Europe is suffering on the back of the energy squeeze. And China is quietly sitting there. And yes, it also has been hit by a reduction in its oil imports, but it has very big reserves of fossil fuels. And it's also very widely diversified heavily into renewables in the last few years. So in some ways, it's better protected. China's also been sitting there watching to see how military equipment is or is not being battle-tested and playing out on the battlefield. And one thing about China is that its own armies haven't fought a war for a very, very long time. It's very keen to see what kind of military innovations are working or not. It's one of the reasons why it's been quietly involved watching Russia as well in Ukraine. So in many ways, China is one of the winners. And to my mind, the best way to understand the global economy today is that we're in a phase of what might be called geoeconomics, in the sense that economic policy making is driven by national security and statecraft dynamics, which means that economics has become a derivative of politics, a consequence of politics, not the other way around, which is the story of our neoliberal globalizing period for the last few decades, when economics was seen as a self-independent thing, which could be so separated from politics that you could actually use tools from physics or maths to model it. You can't do that anymore because politics keeps getting in the way. And within that framework, the world is really shaped by a hegemonic fight, a fight between two hegemons, dominant powers, the US and China, over who's going to control the global economic system. China has hegemonic power by virtue of controlling key supply chain nodes in industry and manufacturing, like rare earth minerals. America has hegemonic power because it controls the dollar as the world's reserve currency in finance. Tech hegemony, AI hegemony, is still being contested. And to some degree, energy hegemony too, which is why we have this fight in the Middle East. But that is the reality. And it means that small countries, mid-sized countries, need to get very smart about who they're going to ally with. And if they're not going to ally with anyone and become a vassal state of China or the US, how they're going to build alliances with other small to medium countries to protect themselves.
while I'd love to delve into that with you, Gillian, I'm conscious that I'm up against it with the clock. So I do want to ask you one other area, and that is, I've been watching your video podcast around the story of money, and it is fascinating. It's exactly as you say, for anybody who's interested in economics or in history or both, it's ideal. But I do want to ask you, as you are, have been recording this, when I look at the current state of money today, I think of how people can access information faster than ever, and real-time data at that. Secondly, how access to the markets through low-cost broking is so much more accessible, and passive investing through exchange-traded funds continues to proliferate. Where do you see the future of how individuals, the people listening to us today, will interact with the financial markets in the future?
That's a very good question. And I think we're going to be seeing two things happening. And by the way, I should say that David McWilliams, great columnist here in Ireland,
we know
has written a lot about that as well. And I'm hoping to get him, do a podcast with him at some point soon. But two things I think are going to be the story of the future. Firstly, growing automation and AI usage, which hopefully will be developed safely. But there's a battle going on around that right now.
But haven't algos been around forever, Gillian?
They have been around forever. However, ordinary consumers have, for the most part, not been dealing with an AI robot as their financial advisor.
Or robo-advisor, you mean?
Robo-advisors, okay. Yes. I suspect that's coming. Secondly, though, you're going to see growing customization and sense of agency or control by individuals. Because historically, there's been a sense where trust tended to be expressed in a vertical form, and you as an individual would trust your financial advisor or your banker or someone in charge to tell you what to do. Increasingly, we're seeing individuals saying, actually, I want to trust myself or my peer group. It's what they call lateral trust, peer-to-peer trust. And with the rise of, you know, people using their mobile phones for payments and for investing and saving, I think you're going to see increasingly people saying, I want to do it myself rather than rely on somebody else, but I may well end up doing it with a robo-advisor instead of your good old friendly, you know, human bank manager.
But with that, Gillian, comes the need for greater financial literacy, I would argue, but more so financial confidence. What do you see will be the architect of that? Is it that because they don't want to be left in a deficit, or because something will happen that will increase their confidence and literacy along the way?
I think we're likely to see more and more risk put onto individuals, which is not good. I hope that governments step in and provide some kind of shelter or safety net, or at least, you know, a basic form of saving account that people can trust. But that's going to be one of the big questions going forward. You know, firstly, who is going to create the kind of AI literacy we need? Is it going to be government doing the training, or companies, or will it be universities or philanthropy, or individuals? And who is actually going to provide the financial literacy we're all going to need in the future?
When you started giving me that answer, I thought to myself, but we have UCITS, we have MiFID, we have a range of regulation to do exactly that, which is to create the safety that people need. However, as you elaborated in your answer, it's the AI literacy to come in the, it would have Venn diagram of finance. That's where you see the new area that people really need to upskill on.
Absolutely. It's going to be a combination of things. And ordinary people don't need to understand the inner workings of AI or the inner workings of financial markets. I mean, that would be unrealistic any more than when you go to your chemist or drugstore and buy a tablet, you know, you'd aspirin, you don't know what actually inside or how it works on you. You just trust that it's going to be good. In the same way, we have to be able to trust AI. We have to be able to trust trust basic, you know, financial products. And it's a bit like saying to somebody, okay, we don't expect you to know what's in penicillin or in an aspirin, but you should know that if you just eat McDonald's every day, you're going to get sick. In the same way, we should know just enough about AI and money to make sure we don't become completely stupid and are able to make informed choices.
It's been an absolute pleasure to have you. Thanks so much indeed for joining us. And a special shout out to your family in Galway, who I know are listening to us today. Thank you very much indeed. Gillian Tett, OBE, columnist and member of the editorial board at the Financial Times.
Thank you.
Now for the answer to my trivia. I was at a medtech conference last week at a stadium in Ireland. Bundy Aki walked past me as I was driving out of the car park. Where do you think I was? Now let me give you the answer, clue by clue. The heart of medtech is in Galway. Bundy Aki plays for Connacht, and so the stadium I was in was the Dexcom in Galway City. So that's it for this week's Taking Stock with me, Susan Ace Culleton. I hope you enjoyed the show and possibly even learned something about economics and how it affects our world. I'll just remind you, the show is available as a podcast first on Friday mornings on the Go Loud app or wherever you go to get your podcasts. And of course, please do pop the link into your WhatsApp groups for anybody else who might be interested. Taking Stock is also on the radio every Sunday morning at 9 a.m.
The producer of the show is John Fardy, and on research this week was Simon Keane and Stephen Daunt. Hugo da Silva Scott was on sound. And next week on the show, we have a very timely new book called How to Win a Trade War. Thanks so much for listening and enjoy the rest of your day. I'm already looking forward to talking to you again next week.
Taking Stock with Susan Hayes-Cullerton on News Talk.
With Nifty Business, the fleet management specialists. Helping businesses unlock growth with a leased vehicle fleet.